Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. On each of our shows, we get a previous guest to ask a question of our current guest. So take a listen.
When was the last time you were in a physical bookstore, and what book did you buy?
And here's how our next guest answered.
The book that I bought for my daughter, who's actually a sixth grader, was President of the Whole Fifth Grade, which is a book with a little black girl on the front.
That's Melissa Harris-Perry, host of the MSNBC show that bears her name, and author of books including Sister Citizen. So, Melissa, I just want to say it's great to talk with you again, in New Orleans, no less. And I'd like to start out with a dedication of the book Sister Citizen, which came out a couple of years ago and is oh so relevant today. So can you just read the dedication for us?
Sure. So the dedication is for James, who is my tea cake, except the part where she shoots him. For Blair, who is my Charlotte, except the part where she dies young. For Parker, who is my everything and always will be.
I thought that was so beautiful. And from the beginning, it sets this tone of connectedness mm-hmm. to Zora Neale Hurston and black literature. So tell me, you go in Sister Citizen, whose subtitle is Shame, Stereotypes, and Black Women in America. You go into a deep dive with Zora Neale Hurston's work on Their Eyes Were Watching God and tying it to the political life of black women. So first, unpack that dedication for us.
Well, so James is my husband, and when I revisited Their Eyes Were Watching God, as I was thinking about the question of black women's politics in America, I revisited the book. This was my opportunity. You know, by the time I was writing Sister Citizen, I was tenured. And so I had more freedom as a political scientist. It did not need to be a straight empirical piece of research. It could have and does have all of that, but I could revisit my undergraduate joy, which was being an English major. And Their Eyes Were Watching God is undoubtedly kind of a transformational text in my life. So I'd gone back to read it, thinking through how Janie Mae Crawford takes us on this kind of journey of self-understanding. And part of what happens is towards the end of it, she marries her true love, Tea Cake, and she goes through basically about three marriages. And Tea Cake is her final marriage. He's younger than her. And he takes her to the Florida Everglades, and they work extremely hard. They survive a hurricane. But then ultimately, he's bitten by a rabid dog and dies because he gets rabies and she ultimately has to shoot him. So there were so many things about how Janie feels about Tea Cake that felt like how I feel about my husband, James. So I initially just said all the time, you know, James is my tea cake. James's father, who is a retired English professor, started saying to him, James, you know, she shoots tea cake at the end.
I love that.
And so, you know, James was like, what?
Watch your back, son.
That's right. So for me, it was, you know, saying all of the things that are the loving and the building and the courageous and the working hard parts, that's the part that makes him my tea cake, but that I have no interest in ending his life at the end. And then for Charlotte, it's about my best girlfriend, Blair, who I've long called my Charlotte. This is from Charlotte's Web, probably my favorite book as a child. And I respond to Wilbur, the pig, you know, the pig who's always feeling like people are coming after him to eat him. And, you know, the pig who worries that, you know, he's in danger. But Charlotte is his great friend. And she's also an exquisite writer. But she teaches him that he is some great pig, right? And she,
yes,
not only does she write to save his life, but she writes to save his sense of self. And that's really who Blair has been to me for more than 20 years. She's my best friend on the planet. And so
Another professor.
She's a professor of history at North Carolina State. We met in graduate school. And I always have said to her, you know, you're my Charlotte. And she says, Melissa, you know, Charlotte dies in the book.
There's a theme here.
There is a theme here. It's terrible. So I had to, again, as I dedicate it to her as my Charlotte, say, but not the part where she dies young.
And of course, Parker is your elder daughter.
Parker is my oldest daughter. At the time, I thought she'd be my only child. And she certainly is my everything, although she shares a little bit of that now with her younger sister, Anna James. But Parker Parker is one of those kids who fills up all the nooks and crannies of your life. She is funny and enormous personality and intelligent and adorable and just everything.
Yeah, and you keep this great book on the set of your show, which is that every guest who comes through on the Melissa Harris Perry Show on MSNBC has to sign a book for Parker the first time they appear.
Parker's idea.
It's brilliant.
I mean, I've got what are literally the first three paragraphs of the book here. So the beginning of this was a woman, and she had come back from burying the dead. Not the dead of sick and ailing with friends at the pillow and the feet. She had come back from the sodden and the bloated, the sudden dead, their eyes flung wide open in judgment. That's from Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. If you ask most people what they think of when they hear the word politics, they are likely to give a definition that includes voters, parties, elections, public policy, and processes of contestation and representation. But formal participation in government is only one part of a more encompassing effort to be recognized within the nation. The struggle for recognition is the nexus of human identity and national identity, where much of the most important work of politics occurs. African American women fully embody this struggle. By studying the lives of Black women, we gain important insight into how citizens yearn for and work toward recognition. To understand Black women's politics, we must explore their often unspoken experiences of hurt, rejection, faith, and search for identity. Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God takes on the task of understanding the heart of a woman and thereby exposes meaningful political truths about hierarchy, oppression, and liberation. This book makes the claim that the internal, psychological, emotional, and personal experiences of Black women are inherently political.
So let's go a little bit further into Sister Citizen. And I was fascinated by the way you did a deep reading of Their Eyes Were Watching God and related it to this idea of the political life of Black women not being just about ballot boxes and elections, but bodies and love and community and all these things. So explain a little bit more about the book and how it relates to some of the themes in Zora Neale Hurston's work.
You know, I consistently believe that social scientists who believe themselves to be kind of removed from their writing a little bit, don't think of ourselves the way that novelists and poets think of themselves, are nonetheless almost always writing about themselves. If you scratch the surface of any sociologist or political scientist or even economist, you'll find their own story back there animating the questions. And when I first started writing Sister Citizen, I was happily married to my first husband and very much trained as an empirical quantitative researcher. And I really started the project thinking that it would be about Black women who hold office and how Black women vote and how they engage in the party system. And then I went through a painful divorce. I went through some pretty hard health crises. I moved to a new city where I felt very isolated in a lot of ways. And as my own experiences of angst, but also of joy began to inform the work, it was less and less about what we typically think of as politics and more about how the life experiences that we have internally actually impact who we are as citizens. More than anything, it was perhaps becoming a single parent. And once I was an African-American single mom, that framework,
a much maligned category.
Exactly, right? That category, that identity, which I never thought I would be. And I did not personally malign it myself, but also had worked really hard my whole life not to be in that category. Suddenly found myself, oh, I'm a Black single mama. And understanding how if you knew my narrative, you'd have one set of assumptions about who I was. But if you knew that piece of me, Black single mama, you would have a whole different set of assumptions. And all of the political meaning that came along with that really informed what this book is.
You also go into an analysis of three archetypes. You do some qualitative research in focus groups with Black women and go into three archetypes / stereotypes, the mammy, the Jezebel, the hot to trot woman, and Sapphire, who's the sassy, angry Black woman. And you go into how many different Black women feel that they are put in these categories in their interactions with other people, Black and non-Black people. What does that do to us as Black women?
So the metaphor I use in the in the book is the idea of the crooked room. I was engaging in reading a bunch of cognitive psychology at this time, and there was this research after World War II about our perceptual field. So this research is not about race or politics or gender or any of that. It's just research about how we orient ourselves in a physical space. And what they do is they take a subject, put them in a room that was dark, and when they flip the light on, all of the angles of the room were off. So instead of, you know, parallel floor and ceiling and walls and 90-degree angles, everything was off. It was literally crooked. And your job as the subject was to figure out how to stand upright in this room where your entire perceptual field was off from your expectations. And I read this, you know, this piece of cognitive psychology research, and I thought, man, that is just what it's like to be a Black woman in America. You are constantly getting this feedback from the world that says you're angry, you're hypersexual, you are a mammy meant to take care of others. And it certainly, some of it comes from what we might think of as a white supremacist racial culture, but a lot of it comes from within Black communities. A lot of it comes within intimate relationships with African American men, both romantic and parental. And what it does is, just as in the research where some people are very good about finding the authentic upright no matter what that perceptual field is doing, but the vast majority of people can tilt themselves, some of them as much as 45 degrees on an angle, but perceive themselves as standing upright because everything around them is distorted. And
everything plays into the trick of the mind.
Absolutely. And so if you are a Black woman growing up in a world that tells you you are hypersexualized, then you might do one of two things. You might conform towards that hypersexuality and perceive it as an authentic expression of self when in fact it is simply conforming to these expectations. Or knowing that you're in a crooked room, you might go too far the other way and try to be hyper respectable and never wear red and always keep, you know, always keep yourself sort of asexualized so as to not create that stereotype. And again, you would experience it as authentic, even if, in fact, what you're doing is overcorrecting. And so part of what I'm doing is looking at how in our politics, we constantly either conform to or overcorrect for these negative images. Anger is the big one. We have a right to be angry about all kinds of things in America, all of the forms of inequality that Black women experience. But we often don't make use of that anger politically because there is this stereotype that Black women just mad. They just mad about something. They mad about nothing. Their anger doesn't have any meaningful content.
You talk in the book about, you know, a term in a work by Hegel, and I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this right because it's German, Anerkennung, which is mutually affirming recognition. And you go into a pretty fascinating analysis of this concept of mutually affirming recognition among members of a civic society like America and how it's given to some and withheld from others. Mm-hmm. How do you think that relates to where we are today in American politics?
When we think about inequality and we think about fairness, we tend to think of it exclusively as a resource distribution question. Do you have equal access to education? Do we have equal opportunities to build wealth? Do we have equal opportunities to earn fair income? Those are resource distribution questions, and they are critically important. And legislation has been part of moving us towards a more egalitarian system, and other kinds of legislation can move us away from it. But even as we deal with the question of resource distribution, we have to recognize that the other part of a democracy is recognition, this Hegelian notion of wanting to be seen. And that for members of marginalized groups, the difficulty is you both want to be seen as an individual, but you want your individual identity to be connected to the group. So most African Americans, not all, but most African Americans are disturbed by the idea of colorblindness, the idea that in order to see me as human, you would have to be blind to my racial identity. So I want you to see me. I want you to see who I am. I want you to see the kind of music I listen to and the kinds of books I read. But I also want you to know I'm Black and to know the ways in which my Blackness informs who I am. This is maybe best represented, this recognition politics, right at this particular political moment by LGBT struggles. Because what you'll often hear is, well, if you're gay, you can just pretend you're not. You can just go into the closet. And so we shouldn't think of these as civil rights struggles because your identity doesn't have to be up front. And so if you just pass as a straight man or a straight woman, then you won't have to worry about not getting housing or not getting work. And usually the argument is, but as a Black person or as a Latino, I cannot, you know, hide my identity. But the closet is not a privilege. In a democracy, people both want to have this fair distribution of resources, but they also want to be seen. So the notion of being able to be freely, openly queer, whether that is gay or whether that is transgender, you need to be able to both be that person and be who you are. So Janet Mock, in her new memoir, is really sort of performing this, where Janet is a transgender woman of color. Her experiences are both uniquely hers, they're just Janet's, but they're also indicative of women of color in general. She, in fact, uses Their Eyes Were Watching God, which is as a frame for her book, which is this interesting moment where I'm like, oh, you're just a sister. Like, you know, we would all respond to this book similarly, even if I'm cisgendered and she's transgender. And those identities, like, she needs you to be able to see her as woman, but also to see her as trans woman, and to see her as a person of color, and to see her as, you know, Janet the Fabulous.
Right.
All at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I really feel the work that I'm doing right now is a deep dive on jobs in the economy. And we're sitting here in New Orleans, and I'll be interviewing a bunch of people who are blue-collar workers in New Orleans while I'm on this trip. And I think that in addition to all of the gender and race and sexual orientation, you know, sort of questions of being seen, there's also a question of the economy and class. And we don't really have a great language for class in America, I think. But if you are of certain classes, you're not seen. And you're meant not to be seen. If you're a waiter in certain establishments, your job is to be invisible.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of blue-collar workers are pretty much asked not to be seen at all.
And rarely ever heard, or not heard at all. I mean, if you think about this city that runs on the engine of tourism, I mean, even that language, tourism, sounds so benign. But what that means is that there are women in this city who make beds, hundreds of beds every single week. And so these women who are going into these hotel rooms and making these beds for these tourists have back problems, have repetitive use injuries, in part because what we want out of a hotel bed now are these big, huge, fluffy sheets and these enormous pillows. And changing those and changing them rapidly over and over again requires a level of strength and repetitive movement that is extremely, but you're never meant to see the woman who cleans your room. In fact, if you do see the woman who's cleaned your room, then she has failed, right? Her job is to become this kind of magical elf that comes in, makes your room clean, and then disappears. Similarly, as you pointed out, for waiters and waitresses in this city, and nothing perhaps more revealing than what is now nearly a decade old, the Katrina disaster, in which the country openly, on television, in media, kept saying, I can't believe these people exist. I mean, you just, commentators over and over again, as they watched people who are my neighbors on the roof of their home, just kept saying, oh, but they've always been invisible. And suddenly it takes this almost biblical level flood for us to bother to see them. And then, of course, they recede back into invisibility.
You're listening to One with Farai, part of Soundworks from PRI, and I'm speaking with Melissa Harris-Perry, host of MSNBC's The Melissa Harris-Perry Show and author of books including Sister Citizen. So what has happened to New Orleans after Katrina? I'm experiencing a bunch of different parts of New Orleans and knowing that what I'm seeing is just, you know, a tiny sliver of life. But, you know, I know it's impossible to summarize, but just give me a couple thoughts on how New Orleans has evolved since Katrina.
It's funny you asked me this at this moment, Farai, because I fairly recently announced that I'm not going to be making my permanent residence in New Orleans anymore. And the people of New Orleans do not take well to folks who come and go, period, much less who come and go relatively swiftly. So I want to tread very carefully here.
It is an academic posting, so it's not like you're deserting
no.
New Orleans and walking away, you know, throwing the lit match over your shoulder, watching the clothes
no.
in the car burn. You know,
no.
you have so much love for this city.
Oh no, and we'll never completely leave it, and our families are still here. But there's an authenticity claim around the city of New Orleans. It was part of what happened in the rebuilding efforts. This sense of people like me who would come in post Katrina and then would leave and maybe didn't have sufficient stake. But I will say, from what I have seen in my time here since the storm, and I've been living here at least part-time, basically for 10 years since the storm, and full-time more recently, I think there are a couple of incredibly important dynamics that are worthy of summary, despite all of the diversity. And one is that after Katrina, African-American political power in this city disintegrated. that African-American political power in New Orleans was probably always very tenuous, very much driven by class. So it wasn't all African-American communities who equally had an opportunity to be part of the governing coalition. But this is a city that had African-American mayors for decades and had majorities on the city council and who had district lines that were drawn in a way that affirmed African-American political power. And since Katrina, that is largely over. When you look at turnout in the city, African-Americans are turning out at something like 35 to 55. They certainly turned out during the presidential election. So both in 08 and in 2012, enormous turnout for President Obama. But in these municipal elections, where the folks who are making the day-to-day decisions about infrastructure and investment in this city, this is a city where Black political power is fundamentally altered over the course of the past decade, and where I think you see in a certain way many African-American communities in the city feeling like political power had did very little for them, that it was not protective, it was not a bulwark against the inequalities that emerged after Katrina. So I think that's one. I think, and as part of that, as part of the question of a disintegration and weakening of Black political power in this city, you also see two very, I mean, there's probably four different cities that have emerged in that there's a kind of Black middle class city, a Black poor city, a white marginal city, and a white ruling class city. But even within those, if you sort of if you draw the line a little more harshly, there really are two cities. And one is dealing with one of the highest murder rates in the country. One is dealing with circumstances of gentrification that are pushing them out of the existing properties. One is dealing with questions of insufficient rental properties, with schools that, despite national media attention, are utterly failing their children. And the other city is seeing the most incredible renaissance of identity and of investment and of new city. And it's been interesting because I've lived in the time that I've lived here, I've both lived in the 7th Ward, and I'm currently renting a place uptown by Tulane. And it is shocking how different my New Orleans experiences are when I was living on North Miro versus living on, God help me, Calhoun, the great segregationist street.
You're integrating.
Yeah.
I got lost on the way here, so I passed by Robert E. Lee twice and waved both times.
Yes, yeah. I mean, living on Calhoun, just, you know, every time I have to turn on that street, I'm like, oh my God, I live on the street of nullification and segregation. So,
well, I could talk to you all day, but we don't have that kind of time. So I wanted to wrap up by asking you a couple different things. First off, what do you think being a public figure has or has not done for you as a person? The people we're talking to for this podcast, one with Farai, are people who all have some kind of public persona. What does it do to you as a mother, as a wife, as a sibling, all the roles that you play, to know that people love you, but also that there's a lot of pressure in that?
Well, right. Some people love me and other people really
don't.
That's
true.
Yeah. I am undoubtedly a polarizing figure, in part because I'm part of opinionated news media, which is inherently polarizing. And then I'm a loud talking Black girl within this ideologically polarized cable media space. So, you know, I don't think anybody wants to hear somebody who earns a lot of money to be on television complain, right?
Yeah, so, and I'm not asking
you
to.
So I don't want to do that. I will say that there have been moments where the public piece has invaded on the private life that are surprising and uncomfortable. At the beginning of 2014, I was dealing with a crisis that had emerged on the show as a result of a comedic segment we'd done where I made the mistake of including an image of Mitt Romney's family, including his adopted African-American grandson. The words that were said at that time were highly offensive to many people, including to many of my viewers who have integrated families, some of them through transracial adoption, who felt very hurt by what happened on the show. And it was a firestorm. It was very ugly and painful. Normally, if it happens because of something I'm proud of, so if I've said something and what I've said I believe and it's controversial, I don't mind the blowback because if I believe it. But in this case, I'd harmed people who I either didn't know or who I cared about. And so it did not feel good to take this criticism, in part because I felt like I deserved much of it. But the hard part was, at one point, like, I'm driving my daughter, sixth grader, to school, and it's on the radio. Like, you know, we always listen to the radio on the way to school, and we're driving to school, and all of a sudden there's this commentator saying how awful Melissa Harris Perry is and what a racist she is. And I just go, and, you know, and I'm turning it off. And it, that moment of my daughter saying, whoa, wait a minute, what are people saying about you? That was, made me feel like I never wanted to buy one of those gossip magazines ever again. I thought, oh, that's what that feels like. So that's part of it. I think the other piece, in addition to the just kind of like how the criticisms can be painful, I think it's like maybe the hardest part is just the forum that I have a public life in. Television is very powerful, but extremely constrained and limited. The number of words that we can say on any given topic, the number of topics that we can take up, the level of complexity that we can bring to them is, I mean, we do the best we can with a two-hour show, which is really a lifetime on TV. But almost every single segment that we do 5 minutes on the show, I sometimes teach whole 15-week semesters on this and assign readings and recognize the multiple viewpoints. And I always walk away feeling like I didn't do justice to the topics that I care the most about. And that, I think, for me, just as a kind of, you know, what I'm committed to professionally, is the hardest part, because I know that I can probably only sustain doing this for a few more years before it will drive me too crazy and I have to go back to spending time in the books and the teaching, because I get to talk to a lot of people, but to a lot of people in ways that always feels like I'm not giving you quite what I really believe here.
Well, I want to ask offer one final question to you. And it's actually a question from our Exquisite series, which is part of this podcast. We get people to ask each other questions. So one of our previous guests is Tanya Selvaratnam, the author of a book called The Big Lie about fertility. You recently have written about having your new baby via surrogacy after having a hysterectomy because of fibroids. You are so clearly tied to books and deep dives and literature. So I want to play you a little bit of a question that Tanya had for you.
When was the last time you were in a physical bookstore, and what book did you buy?
Oh, so interestingly enough, this is connected to the fertility question. So the last physical book that I bought is a book called President of the Whole Fifth Grade. Which I bought. Actually, I was, there's probably a whole series of them that I bought. I bought a ton of the kids' books, the baby books. So let me back up. I do have a new daughter who is now, just under 3 months old. She was born Valentine's Day, and she was born via surrogacy. There was a lot of reading that occurred as a result of this. I had a lot of angst as a feminist about the idea of surrogacy as a journey. You know, I knew from the beginning that I was unable to carry a pregnancy, but that I could in fact have my own biological kid. The question of whether or not having your own biological kid is a relevant aspect of parenting, I think, is a tough one in and of itself. What we think genes are, you know, whether we think kids come to us via nurture or nature. And I am certain after raising a 12-year-old that there's a little bit of, but some of it is they just show up like that. They just are that person. But my husband and I made this decision to go forward and to have our own kid, our own bio kid, using the reproductive technologies engaged with surrogacy. And in fact, the woman who served as my surrogate, she and I had a series of books that we sort of did as a book club together, she and I reading. And it was extremely useful for us sometimes to engage in reading other people's stories and then talk about them with one another, because it kind of removes some of the emotional angst of saying, I feel this way. Instead, you could say, so I would say to her, I do not want to be like those awful intended mothers that are in the book. Please tell me if I ever behave in that way, right? It was very useful. But the last time that I was physically standing in a bookstore was over the Christmas holidays. Baby was born February 14th, so we knew she was on the way. So we just went and bought, you know, all the books for Christmas that I give to my nieces and nephews, also books for my daughter who's 12, and then books for the baby. And so although I can't remember what all the baby books were, they were probably something like, you know, chickens and I love my hair.
Caterpillar,
right? All who knows. But the book that I bought for my daughter, who's actually a sixth grader, was President of the Whole Fifth Grade, which is a book with a little black girl on the front who, of course, runs for president of the whole fifth grade. And, you know, part of what gave me extraordinary pleasure about buying that was that I could just be standing. I mean, I don't even think we were standing in some sort of independent bookstore. We were probably in a Barnes & Noble or something because we were at the outlet mall. The fact that that book was just on the shelf and I could just reach over and get it, it's very different than when I was 12 years old. And her level of expectation that that sort of book should be there and that it ought to be available to her and that we ought to be able to read it together. And of course, some substantial portion of the characters that she's going to read about will be adolescent girls and adolescent girls of color and girls who she relates to. You know, she's a child who's the only president that she remembers is President Obama and Sasha and Malia and Michelle Obama. And so for her, there's a kind of ordinariness to it that maybe makes the room a little less crooked for her.
Before I let you go, I have one more bit of housekeeping for you to do, which is to toss a question to the next person, although we're not going to tell you who it is. You get to ask them anything.
What do you think of as your greatest failure?
You'll find out the answer to Melissa's question on the next episode of One with Farai. Melissa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Melissa Harris-Perry is the host of MSNBC's The Melissa Harris-Perry Show, and author of books including Sister Citizen. You've been listening to One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm your host and executive producer, Farai Chidea. This program is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Our theme music is by the band Betty. Catch our next episode as we speak with actor and entrepreneur Wendell Pierce. He's been in everything from the shows Tremé and The Wire to films including Waiting to Exhale.
One with Farai is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI. Oh.